the duty to make a difference. The great religious and philosophical question is the same. It's the question about the meaning of life. And what is the meaning of life? And the first person that says 42 is out of here, Jennifer. Although it is true. Okay. It's a Doug Adams reference. People argue about whether this is a question of meaning is inherent, that God put meaning into our lives and it's our job to find it. And the existential philosophical position is we create meaning with our lives, with our choices, with what we do and what we don't do. These seem to be polar opposites, but my MO is to really deny polar opposites. I think that there's a way that is a both and. Because whether what we do creates or uncovers the meaning isn't as important as acknowledging that what we do is important in bringing meaning into the world, in making it visible, in making it have an impact. It isn't simply an abstract idea. It is a search to try to create value by living out the examined values that we have. And so the great philosophical question is fun for an evening sitting by the campfire or drinking wine. But the real question is, what do we do? What do we believe? And how do we concretize those beliefs in actions? We have, I believe, and that's the premise of my talk this morning, a duty to make a difference in this world, and we have the ability to make a difference in this world, a good difference. When I read the Bible, and yes, I do, and study it, and translate it, and work, and wonder at it all, even as a kid, I had a problem with the Genesis Garden of Eden story, because Adam and Eve have not eaten of the knowledge of the difference between good and evil. And so God says, don't eat the fruit. And they ate the fruit. Why should they have listened to God? They had no idea what the difference of good and evil was. They had incomplete moral information. Now, the way to get around that problem is to see it as a metaphor, to see it as a fable that has truths in it, but they aren't on that literal level. The truths are in we human beings, so far as we know, on this planet, are unique moral agents. Other animals, and we are animals, as your relative would, at least the men, would say, we are animals, and animals have instincts, some of them good, some of them ferocious, instincts to breed, to share, to sacrifice. But we, as far as we know, uniquely have the ability to choose against instincts, to make choices about what we do, about how we either go with or against our impulses. And I'm not saying which to do. That's an individual choice. But we have that ability. And to me, that whole Garden of Eden story is talking about how is it that we grow into becoming moral agents, responsible people, responsible for ourselves, our choices, and responsible to a larger society and community. And I see it as a metaphor of growing up. Children are born naked. They don't feed themselves. They don't clothe themselves. They don't work for a living. They're just kind of there sleeping, looking cute, and ready to be changed. And all the time. But when a three-year-old pushes or scratches or takes something, it's not the act of a moral agent as it would be at 8 years old or at 13 years old or at 16 years old or at 20. We grow into a sense of our power and our responsibility to be the unique moral agents in the world. And I think that that's really important. When I look at the biblical text, there are other problems that relate to the sermon this morning. And those are some translation problems. It looks like God makes a big mistake in Genesis when God says, well, man, Adam, doesn't mean male, but since he was the only one at the time, I've created you in my image and given you dominion over all the world. Now, if God was too optimistic in thinking that Adam and Eve weren't going to eat the fruit, giving men the idea that they are just little gods made in the image of God and giving them dominion, control over the world, would seem like the act of a really fallible God who was just waiting for the sports to come on ESPN so that he could guide the football into the hands of the right people. But that's not what it says actually in the Hebrew. Now, I know for 2 weeks I've been team teaching with a rabbi, and so I'm going to give you some Hebrew today. The word that is used for image is betzelem, and it doesn't mean image. It means shadow. It's the word that's used in the 23rd Psalm for the shadow of death. And it's very different to say we were born as a shadow of the divine as opposed to an image, because we are as a fleeting shadow in the grand expanse of the blue sea home or the infinite skies. And the word dominion, while it is hierarchical in the Hebrew, it means that you are on the top for responsibility. It's not about the way it gets translated as power, but it's far more a sense of responsibility to tend the garden, to take care of the garden, to have the responsibility to be good stewards of this life, of this planet, of our time that we share here under the sun. And added paragraph to the sermon that because of the song that we sang about breathing. That's another great mistranslation that comes out of the Bible where it says, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Well, I'm not saying vanity of vanities, because the Hebrew is havel havalim. Havel havalim, a marco haleth, hakol havel. It means breath. It's about breathing. And breath is central. It's not a vanity, but it's invisible. It's not really quantifiable in ancient days, but it's the animated principle. It is inspiration filling us with life. It is somebody expires. It's, and the question, the great ethical, moral, philosophical, religious question is, what do we do with this breath? What do we do to make this breath reflect, not just give us life, but give us a life that is fully connected to the world and to each other? How do we turn our breath, our heartbeats, our lives into actions that make a difference? We're starting our stewardship season, and this is a stewardship sermon, and stewardship is about not simply money. Money is an expression of some of our priorities. It is about how we handle our resources. And what is our most precious resource? You don't have to be a capitalist, Jim. You don't have to be a capitalist to know that scarcity is related to value. If our streets were literally paved with gold, gold would have no value. If you tripped over diamonds all over the beach, we would not care about diamonds. So what is precious? What resource do we really need to look at? And it is breath. It is time. We are so short in terms of time. When I look at the nearly, apparently, infinite universe flying apart faster and faster, when I look at the billions of years that creation has been here up until this brief moment, when I contemplate the billions of years that I have to assume, not being a solipsist, that are going to go on when my time here is finished, as the universe continues to grow and expand and maybe recreate itself somehow, I don't know, and I won't find out. I have to say, in this tiny flash of light, in this tiny flash of life, the great question is, how shall I spend it? How shall I spend all of my resources? Because this is what I have. It is not infinite to give. It is not infinite to spend. But our finitude can overwhelm us, or it can inspire us. The idea that there is not world enough and time enough that we can sit out an election season, that we can sit out a great issue, that we can just sit in the Garden of Eden and eat and drink and make love, as nice as that sounds, we can try to figure out a way to turn that grape juice into wine. But that is not simply selfish, but that is the reverse of being truly selfish, because it diminishes the self. The self is created when we connect with each other. The self is nourished when we find ways of being with each other, of seeing each other as fully human, as knowing that we are a part of the world. For all of our problems as a nation, we have extraordinary abilities to make a difference. For all of our individual challenges, whether emotional or financial, we in this room have extraordinary abilities to make a difference. How we control the stewardship of our life and all of our various resources, of time, of talent, of treasure, is a critical philosophical, religious, and moral question. What do we care about? What can we do? What can we change? What can we encourage? And the thing about life is, it's an incomplete information problem. We don't know what the ultimate results of our actions are. We don't know when a smile has made a huge difference, a frown has made a terrible difference, when we reached out to help somebody, what that meant 3 weeks or 3 years or 3 decades later. But we do know that each of us builds and leaves a legacy of what we have done and of the choices that we have made. Horace Mann, a famous Unitarian educator, philosopher, said, "Be ashamed to die until you have achieved some victory for mankind." Not sure that I would use the word shame myself, because that's kind of old-fashioned guilt rap, but I understand the truth of that, the motivation of that, the idea that these moments that we have under the sun, these precious heartbeats, this light that shines on us and from us, we can choose to have it make a difference. It doesn't have to make all of the difference. The idea that if I don't win, I don't play, that this cause looks like a lost cause, I don't accept that. We do, in real time, in small time, small things. Mother Teresa had a wonderful line. She said, "You know, I don't do great things. I do small things with great love." And that's the love that changes everything. It's not a philosophical or emotional, as I talked about last week. It is something that we do. We do life. We do love. We do our values. With our modern world and where we live, we are connected and powerful beyond the dreams of kings of all other ages. We can, with our internet, with satellite technology, with Google World, focus in and zoom in on every conflict, every celebration, all the acts of barbarism, all the acts of generosity. We can take this God's eye view, and become overwhelmed by all of the pain, or we can be drawn into the work of doing small things with great love, of seeing the humanity in the stranger, of seeing ourselves in each other's eyes as we are reflected, as engaging terrific and great and complex issues in good faith and with great respect for those who differ, and to care about the world. There are a lot of instincts in our society that train us not to treat each other with respect. This is very personal with me today. I have an article in three newspapers about the Quran burnings in Afghanistan. I was against it. And I've gotten so far a lot of hate mail telling me how embarrassed my parents must be that I'm so rotten. We can differ without name-calling. We can say, am I understanding this correctly? We can say, we're working together on opposite sides in good faith without demonizing the other. We can be involved in the great complex issues of life without agreeing. We do not have to think alike in order to love alike. And that's what loving alike is. It's loving our earth. It's loving this time. It's loving the opportunity that we have to heal a broken world, to make a difference, to leave a legacy that is intentionally made up of our values and our actions that have derived from those values. Don't be ashamed to die before you have achieved a victory for mankind. The victory isn't as important as the struggle, as the engagement, because the victory may be the inspiration that each of us leaves to another person and another generation, because we have used our resources, our money, our education, our power, our time to reflect our values. And we need to be connected with one another. It is very difficult to be either moral or immoral sitting alone in a cave. It may be nice, but you then are back in the Garden of Eden and you become not necessarily a moral agent. We need each other. We need each other to inspire one another. We need each other to correct one another. We need each other to pick up and to hold and to heal one another. And so we come together. We come together in clubs. We come together in secular organizations. We come together in churches, in temples, in synagogues, in ashrams, in all different kinds of ways, so that we are on this wonderful, long, terribly short trip, not alone. We live together, we work together, we sing together, we weep together. We are together in this time, under this sun, in this beautiful flash of light, under these amazing skies. And what a joy, what a pleasure, what an opportunity, what a challenge.